Well, that's the crucial thing, isn't it? How do we bring the discussions together with the reality? And that's what I wanted to bring you on to now. We're at a really interesting time for making global policy, which possibly makes making environmental policy between the rich countries and the developing world harder, and possibly it makes it easier. Tom, can you talk about a bit about how do we do greenery in a recession? How can we bring these things together? Do they conflict or do they help each other?
You have to separate the discussion on the politics of this from the discussion on the policy. And that one of the reasons for getting out of the green ghetto, indeed the climate ghetto, is to get away from endless discussion of the minutiae of the policy, because that isn't how we're going to do it. And you need to remember that international treaties consolidate political bargains that have already been made. They're outputs from those bargains, they're not inputs to them. And to some extent, we've got off in the wrong direction on climate change. That doesn't mean the negotiations aren't very important. In a sense, part those, they'll run their course in the way Charlie just described.
Can I just stop you? Just talk to me a little bit about that very interesting distinction between the politics and the policy.
Policy is the map of how you get from here to there. Politics is the journey. You use different tools to make a map than you do to make the journey. And quite often in making the journey, you're using the instruments and the tools you've got on the other people you want to take along with you. So it's a much more crude and brutal process, which is why I said at the beginning, the key to the politics of this is aligning up the stimulus packages. Because what will actually bring about the technology transformation that we need is not detailed agreements about emissions and sharing of burden and all that stuff, which will go on forever. What will bring it about is the kind of public spending I've talked about on the scale I've talked about. And if that's done essentially by the EU, by China and by the US, then the rest of the world will follow. Now, that's a political process. It's not a policy process. The countries don't need to agree their precise measures and so on. They don't even need to agree to go together, but they have to agree to point in the same direction and to align the scale of ambition that they've got for that. Now, that's not instead of the negotiations, but if you don't do that, then the negotiations get bogged down in this sort of swamp of minutiae because there isn't enough political space and political momentum to force people to agree. If you start creating the alternative you want to see, then people follow that. And that's why I'm optimistic about Obama, just in a resurgence of hope, not because I think our prospects are yet all that much better, but at least it seems to me he understands the importance of creating a sort of political impulse on the right scale for this. And he explicitly links what we have to do on economic recovery and what we have to do on energy and climate.
OK, I can see that. But isn't this a pretty dreadful time to ask any government to start spending large amounts of new money on anything? I mean, we're pouring vast quantities of taxpayers' money down a black hole called the banking system at the moment. Dave, do you think one can reconcile these two rather difficult aims?
Well, I think on the policy versus politics side, the thing I worry about there is what are the arguments people deploy for cap and trade systems as opposed to taxes is you build a constituency around the policy and therefore you have a bunch of people whose vested interests lie in the maintenance of the policy, and the argument against taxes, well, they won't be there long. And it's interesting to see Exxon come out in favour of tax, presumably on the grounds that everybody likes repealing taxes. But I think there is a danger. The same danger occurs with creating communities who are recipients of large-scale public funds. And that's if you create political inertia behind a policy process that you haven't thought through properly, that you subsequently decide you really aren't that keen on, it's much harder to unpick. And I think so. I think I agree.
Do you have any examples of that?
If you tried to unpick something like the emissions trading system, I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad policy, but if you wanted to do something like that, it would be pretty hard. A better example is probably the common agricultural policy, actually. Personally, I think undermines a lot of European claims to moral leadership in the environmental arena. But if you try and unpick something like that, you find that the reasonably small number of people who have a massive vested interest in it end up making sure, but they have a very strong vested interest in it, they make sure that the thing continues to exist. So you lose the ability to revise policy if you decouple too much the politics from the policy.
And Tom, could one not also cite the American biofuel subsidy as an example of this? You have huge government spending, gets poured into the pockets of farmers, it gets sold on a green basis, turns out to be a really bad, not at all green, incredibly expensive policy. And does that not end up somewhat discrediting the whole tackling climate change cause?
Possibly. I mean, you just remember that the corn subsidies for ethanol production were being sold long before people were as anxious as they are now about ethanol, and had lots to do with Tom Daschle getting votes in Dakota. So I think you want to be careful. But there are going to be mistakes. Don't kid yourself that making the kind of transformation we're talking about we need to do, and we need to really get going in the next 3 or 4 years, making that kind of transformation is not going to be mistake-free at all. But partly why I said the way we should do the tax is linking the tax to the emissions, so that as the emissions go down, then the tax yield goes down, precisely to get out of the kind of trap that the CAP can produce for you. So there are ways to work your way around that. But right now, I don't think there is a serious political impulse to deal with this problem. I think that what was being said earlier on by Charlie and Dave about the sense of the slowness of the process is right. So sitting around arguing about what's the best way to pay for Spitfires or Hurricanes in September 1938 is, you know, maybe entertaining, but it's probably not going to help you very much. And I don't mind if in the process of trying to get the Spitfires and Hurricanes, we build 3 or 4 other planes that don't work, because we're in that kind of state.
See, I don't agree that we're in that kind of state. I don't think that the sense of urgency is like that of a war. And I think that the risk of analogy, making an analogy between a war and climate change, is that, one, in a war, people are prepared to undergo hardship because they know exactly what it would be like to win. They understand there's a finitude to it. They know what the victory conditions are. They know it's temporary, and they can see the end game. And I don't think those things.
Like the war on terror.
Actually, I think a war on carbon would be just a lot like a war on terror, a war on drugs.
I think a war metaphor doesn't help us very much here, but a wartime footing might. And I think the idea that there's that the urgency isn't there, I think it's not. I mean, if you look at the recent science, I think the science says it all. But I think even if you don't look at it in scientific terms, look at it in infrastructure investment terms, there is going to be hundreds of millions of euros spent on electricity power sector infrastructure, regardless of whether you believe climate change was happening or not. The chance we've got right now, combined with the economic downturn, is that we do that, that infrastructure can be guided in Tom's terms, in the right direction of travel. Of course there are going to be mistakes in, you know, certain technologies aren't going to deliver as much as they should, or the implementation of certain technologies. You only have to look at the growth of wind and then the crash of wind in California in the 70s. And there was one simple reason. It was an investment tax credit, not a production tax credit. So you could make money by building wind farms. You didn't have to generate any electricity from them. Simple policy interventions can make actually a big difference, and you can make adjustments to make sure they deliver the right outcomes. But if you go back to corn ethanol, I mean, it was never about climate change. It was always about fuel security in the United States. And I think a lack of honesty.
Always about votes.
And votes combined with the rhetoric of independence from Middle East oil. I grew up in the Great Plains, I know about what we used to call pork barrel politics. And it's very, very powerful in the United States. But you can turn pork barrel politics into a reasonable outcome if what you're clearly identifying is the right outcome. And I think there was a real, you know, it was just downright dishonesty in the biofuel boondoggle, I'm afraid.
Okay, what, Charlie, is your sense of what to me is probably the crucial question over the next couple of years, which is, in America, how do the forces for tackling climate change play against the forces resisting the urge to tackle it? And, you know, who are they on both sides? And how do you feel that game's going to play out?
Well, it's really interesting, and it's incredibly fluid at the moment. You know, one of the most successful oil men in the late 20th century is a guy called T. Boone Pickens, who is an absolutely compelling and persuasive advocate for a renewable economy, for moving away from oil, for electric-powered vehicles, massive investment in onshore wind, you know, on the Great Plains, the kind of thing that even 4 or 5 years ago would have been a Texas oil man would have been considered unthinkable. I think bizarrely, wonderfully, ironically, you know, the California Climate Action Plan and Schwarzenegger's leadership has been extraordinary. You know, the combination of output efficiency standards for power stations, low carbon fuel standards, which means that the oil derived from the Canadian tar sands will never be sold in the lower 48, you know, the continental United States. They are really exciting and quite remarkable transformations in a short period of time. But they've got to deal with the coal states. And so there is this massive massive counterweight to, you know, the progressive policies in, you know, mountaintop mining and old-fashioned extractive industries. And those tensions are playing out in quite a different way than I would have expected a couple of years ago, but they're very real. And although there might be differences of opinion around the table for the potential for carbon capture, I think it's a real thing. I just don't think it's going to be a real thing in the time frame we've got conveniently available to us.
So, what is that time frame? Because I think this is another point of disagreement.
Well, it depends on who you ask. I mean, when you, E.ON, we're pretty clear that, you know, the big European utilities have been pretty clear. They don't see it happening at any kind of industrial scale, utility scale before mid-2020s, maybe 2030. That's not soon enough, which then brings that conflict between the coal states and California, to put it crudely, in sharp focus.
Charlie, Tom, Dave, I think you're all, I'm happy to say, a little more optimistic than I expected. Thanks very much.